Chapter 11. The Big Smoke. In late November 1965, my mother came to Toowoomba in Queensland to pick me up from the Glenny Memorial School where I'd just completed my Year 12 studies. I was filled with joy at the prospect of being free of the rigid boarding school regime that I'd begrudgingly endured for 2 long years. Just before I left school, I went for my driving test. As I'd been driving since I was 12 years old, I assumed it was a foregone conclusion I'd passed the test with flying colors. Ahead of time, I'd had a couple of lessons to refine my driving technique, and, as anticipated, I succeeded first go. I was super proud to be the holder of a freshly issued Queensland driver's license. At last, I was legal. I was just 17. My mother drove into the school's front drive, in a very swank chocolate brown and white Volkswagen Karmann Gear 1500S that she brought down with her from New Guinea. The car was unkindly referred to by some as a poor man's Porsche, and I understand. It was one of only 4 in the country. My mother relished the exclusivity. After numerous tearless farewells, we drove downtown to Lennon's Hotel, which was the place to stay in Toowoomba at that time. Lennon's was renowned for an adventurous menu, including bomalaska, an exquisite dessert of vanilla ice cream, encased in sponge cake, covered with baked meringue and served flambé. The perfect treat to celebrate my escape from boarding school. Next day, we headed south to Sydney to stay with a close family friend, Helen Klausner. Helen lived in a 2-story house, designed by modernist immigrant architect Harry Seidler, at Hunters Hill. Well, actually it was Gladesville, the adjoining suburb. But Hunters Hill was considered a much better address. I loved visiting Helen. She had style in spades, possessing both a generous loving nature and a beautiful figure. Helen's wardrobe was always overflowing with unconventional designer clothes, and, to my delight, she was happy to share them with me. Helen was also a fantastic cook. In most Australian households at that time, the patriarchal expectation was that dinner would be on the table no later than 6 o'clock each evening. This was an expectation that Helen chose to ignore. At Helen's house, dinner was served when the dinner was ready, and not before. She was never apologetic. It could be 7, or 8, or even 9 o'clock before the food came to the table, and it was always worth waiting for. Not far from Helen's house, there was a small shopping center with a hairdressing salon. For special occasions, the hairdresser would put my long straight brown hair up into a French roll, a very popular 1960s hairstyle. With a French roll, Helen's borrowed clothes and matching high-heeled slingback shoes, I felt I held my own in the Sydney fashion stakes. We spent Christmas catching up with friends. But the dreamy summer holiday, spent celebrating my escape from boarding school, was short-lived, as there was the pressing need for me to produce a folio of artwork to submit for consideration to the selection committee of the National Art School. I'm almost certain that my acceptance was the result of my mother's influence, and not necessarily the contents of my folio. Many of the art school staff were her colleagues, as she taught hand weaving and textile design at the University of Technology in the years before we moved north to the wilds of New Guinea. With my mother's return to New Guinea imminent, the next challenge we faced was to find a suitable place for me to live in Sydney, ideally within striking distance of the National Art School. A friend suggested Tremaine in Carabella Street, Kirribilli. It was a respectable YWCA hostel, providing accommodation for out-of-town girls, some studying and some working, located just up the road from Kirribilli House, the Prime Minister's official Sydney residence. As New Guinea was my home, I fitted the Tremaine selection criteria, and was offered a room, and then another, where I remained for all 3 years of my art school training. Over the Christmas break I began finding new friends. I met the members of a 3-piece folk band, calling themselves the Ornithologists. Brian Cooper, Greg Kingsley, and Paul Patent. All 3, with more than a passing interest in birds. Brian played guitar and banjo, Greg played guitar, and Paul sang like an angel. They performed covers of popular folk singers, including Bob Dylan, Peter Paul and Mary, The Seekers and The Byrds, and often had weekend gigs around Sydney, their only opportunity to perform as they all had full-time jobs. I took up with Paul, the group's front man, who was drop-dead gorgeous. I often went with them, when they played in coffee shops and church halls, that were packed full of their fans. From the sidelines, I noticed many girls had their eye on Paul, and I remember smiling to myself thinking, this good-looking fella is my boyfriend. Paul was a year older than me, and worked with the Bank of New South Wales. Neither of us had our own transport, though, occasionally Paul was able to borrow his family's Daimler. He would drive from Hunters Hill, where he lived with his recently widowed mother, to visit me at Tremaine, a 20-minute run. Paul's mother was a kind and inclusive woman, who taught me how to iron a man's shirt, as well as introducing me to rabbit stew. This was a new and surprisingly delicious culinary experience for me, because, in my family, we didn't eat rabbit. The ornithologists were also deeply engrossed in the Sydney music scene, often travelling some distance, to hear other groups play. They were overjoyed when they heard that the Modern Jazz Quartet would give one only performance at Sydney University, on their way to Japan. Naturally, we all went along, well aware that the MJQ's music was known and loved worldwide. The MJQ concert was a formative experience for me, as it was the first time I'd heard African-American jazz musicians play on stage. Another close family friend was Kitty Gall, who worked in public relations, and, as a result, knew everybody who was anybody in Sydney, and beyond. Her social circle included artists, musicians, journalists, public intellectuals, and writers, including Charmian Clift, and her husband, George Johnson. The couple had lived with their three children, on Hydra Island, in Greece, for some years. The family had recently returned to Australia, and were finding it difficult to fit back in. Kitty decided to throw a New Year's Eve party at her Mosman flat, and Charmian was invited. I too, was invited, and with permission, brought the ornithologists along with me, for an evening of fun. I clearly remember a tipsy Charmian cornering us to lament how difficult it was to converse with her teenage daughter, because she was in perpetual motion, go-go dancing, morning, noon and night. Go-go dancing was the exciting dance craze sweeping Sydney at the time. Charmian told us that she often pleaded with her saying, please keep still. I've forgotten what you look like. We thought her comments were both amusing and sad. Yet another pre-art school experience was a brush with the Mosman branch of the Young Liberals. My new friend, Mary Ann Walters, was a card-carrying member. She encouraged me to join, and, in what seemed like seconds, I found myself with the job of minutes secretary of the branch. This was my first and last tango with either committee structures or conservative politics. To this day, I've not mastered the skill of taking minutes of meetings. My problem is that I become so engrossed in the toing and froing of the discussion, I find it impossible to keep track of the main points. But I digress. I was delighted to be back in Sydney, as it was my hometown before we headed north to live in New Guinea. I'd been away for 5 years. However, in the couple of months I'd been back, I'd already found an interesting cross-section of new friends, a boyfriend, had a place at the National Art School, and reasonably priced accommodation. How much better could it be? I was poised, ready to begin my first year, at the North Sydney campus of the National Art School. Fortunately, the campus was within striking distance of Tremaine. As the result of my extraordinarily positive art experience at boarding school, I was very excited at the prospect of learning more about art, both theoretical and practical, under the tutorship of a number of highly respected practicing artists. The future looked rosy. On reflection, a Queensland driver's license, Acquiring my driver's license was an important rite of passage. After successfully completing the compulsory driving test, I was thrilled at last to be legal. I loved driving. Driving without a license in New Guinea was never a problem, but driving without a license in the city was asking for trouble. Tremaine, the YWCA hostel at Kirribilli in Sydney. Living at Tremaine gave me the opportunity to meet many interesting young women my own age, who mostly came from different parts of rural and regional New South Wales. As our friendships developed, we were able to support each other, as we ventured out into the world, beyond Tremaine's protective walls. As young, attractive women, we were sometimes confronted with situations that tested us both physically, morally, and philosophically. It was very comforting to know that when needed, we had a shoulder to cry on. Ironing a man's shirt. I was touched when my boyfriend Paul's mother offered to teach me how to iron a man's shirt. Obviously, shirt ironing was a skill she felt I needed. I didn't have the heart to tell her I'd been ironing my father's shirts since I was 8 years old. However, her method was a little different, so it wasn't a wasted exercise. Paul Patent. As I recall, my relationship with Paul lasted for about 18 months, and during that time we shared my virginity. It was a disappointing experience, under less than ideal conditions, after which I played it safe, as I was in no hurry to repeat the experience. Charmian Clift. Meeting the acclaimed author and journalist Charmian Clift at Kitty Gall's party was an unexpected surprise, as I'd grown up hearing lots of stories about her life, before she and her husband, George Johnson, left Australia for London, in 1951. Some years later they moved to Greece, making a home on Idra Island, and in 1957, my mother visited them there. She was on her way back from the United States of America, after spending 6 months studying at the Rhode Island School of Design. She was entranced by the Johnsons' idyllic Greek lifestyle, and, after divorcing my father, thought seriously about moving us to Greece. However, my father threw a spanner in the works, refusing to allow me to leave Australia. So my opportunity to attend the international school in Athens, and learn to speak Greek, instead morphed into learning to speak Tok Pisig, the lingua franca of New Guinea. Seems my father wasn't worried about our move to New Guinea. Perhaps because it was closer? It's strange how things work out. But I digress. Even as a typically egocentric 17-year-old, it was clear to me that Charmian Clift was deeply unhappy as we made small talk, whilst waiting to welcome in the new year of 1966. Facts. Charmian Clift. In 2016, Susan Johnson, feature writer for the Australian newspaper, wrote of Charmian Clift and George Johnson. America has Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes, England has Leonard and Virginia Woolf, and France has Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. But Australia's own doomed literary couple endures, in the myth of Charmian Clift and George Johnson. Charmian died by her own hand, in 1969, aged 45. Her estranged husband, George, died of tuberculosis in 1970, aged 58.